Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is Monday, March 17th, 2008, 1:35 p.m. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Terrio, Senator Walkowski, myself, Senator French, and we are going to hear first up today SB 293, a bill brought to us by Senator McGuire. And Senator McGuire, I'll turn to you.
I am going to defer to my staff. Trevor Fulton, please.
Mr. Fulton, please take a seat at the witness chair, introduce yourself, and tell us about SB 293.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Senator Liesl McGuire. And I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 293. The overarching intent of Senate Bill 293 is to protect personal and consumer privacy and to nip a burgeoning potential for identity theft in the bud. Senate Bill 293 does this by regulating the use of RFID technology in the state of Alaska. But before we get too far into the intent and the meat of the bill, I hope the committee will bear with me while I go into a little bit of background detail information about RFID. If not for the committee members' sakes, then at least for those who may be in the audience or listening.
Is this the first hearing on the bill?
No, sir.
It's been through another committee.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was.
I still need the background, so go ahead.
The bill was heard in Labor and Commerce twice, and this is its third hearing, first one Judiciary, of course. Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, and we should all be working on a backslash echo is the one I have in front of me. Correct?
Correct, Mr.
Please,
Chairman.
Please proceed.
Okay, going into a little bit of background on RFID. RFID, it's an acronym. It stands for Radio Frequency Identification. You'll hear to me refer to it as RFID. Some people call it RFID, but it all pretty much means the same thing. And what it is a wireless technology that typically includes three elements. A tag, which has an antenna and is capable of transmitting transmitting data. And these tags range anywhere in size from about the size of a deck of cards to, I just read a report that they just created a new one in a lab that's about the size of the tip of this pen, if not thinner. So they can be very tiny and they can be put on just about any object out there. So it consists of a tag, a reader, which receives data transmitted by the tag, and a database, which stores all the information that's being exchanged. Some common examples of RFID include employee access passes, like the ones we use to get in and out of the Capitol building here. Payment cards that don't have to be swiped down on the lower 48. You'll see that a lot more than you will up here, but you're starting to see commercials on television. I think Visa's carrying a credit card that has an RFID chip in it. That's one perfect example. Toll passes, again in the lower 48, you see toll pass booths where you don't actually have to stop or slow down, put the money in, you just drive right through. That's all done via RFID. And finally,
Mr. Fulton, are you saying this is an RFID device?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you for the visual. Another common example are pet implants. And, all these things I've named are they're a good thing for the consumer, they're a good thing for the public, and they're certainly not something that we negatively want to impact with this bill. There's some less overt examples out there that you may not have heard of, though, including U.S. Food and Drug Administration-approved RFID tags that can be implanted in humans and contain patient records for use in hospitals. Sounds kind of Orwellian, but they're actually doing this. They're also using RFID tags in supply chains to track the movement of products from a manufacturer to a distributor to a retailer and any points in between. That can mean when you're out there shopping around in some more high-tech grocery stores, they can actually track your location, your movements, how much time you spend looking at certain items. In the future, they're predicting that you could even walk right through scanners set up at the doors and never have to go through a checkout line if all the items had these RFID tags on them. Of course, that's looking far ahead. Getting back to what we're addressing, though, as you can see by this list, one of the biggest benefits of RFID is convenience. This convenience could come at the cost of security, though, and that's why we have before you Senate Bill 293. Private information transmitted by RFID tags and stored in RFID bases, private information like bank account numbers, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, even health records. All this information being transmitted really leaves consumers, or can leave consumers, vulnerable to identity theft. And that's why we're trying to regulate it in the state of Alaska with Senate Bill 293. It aims to minimize that vulnerability and protect personal and consumer privacy by regulating the use of RFID technology in the state of Alaska. RFID use is growing, and as its use becomes more widespread, it'll become increasingly important that, one, consumers are informed that a product they're buying is carrying an RFID tag. Consumer consent and inform is a big part of this bill. Businesses using RFID technology to transmit or store personal information obtain consumer consent to do so. Again, a big part of the bill. We adopt minimum security standards for RFID use. Right now, we don't have any minimum standards for encryption technology used on this personal information that's being relayed from a tag to a reader. We don't have any minimum standards of security for the information that's stored in databases either, and this bill would aim for both. We prohibit scanning or reading of an RFID tag without consent. Right now on the internet, it's reported that you can get a RFID reader the size of a cell phone, and with some simple encryption software that you can again buy on the internet, and a laptop computer, it's been shown in lab tests that you can basically crack people's personal information that's being transmitted from things like their credit cards or whatever other RFID tags they may be carrying. And Senate Bill 293 also establishes enforcement measures for the misuse of RFID devices. And what we did with this bill was make a violation of anything in this act a unfair trade practice. And there are certain implications involved with that. I believe we have Ed Sniffen online from the Attorney General's office who can give a lot better description of that than I can. So Senate Bill 293 establishes RFID regulations where none exist, and by doing so it aims to safeguard personal and consumer privacy and stay ahead of those who would misuse this growing technology. The bill is in essence a proactive bill, but when it comes to consideration of Senate Bill 293, I ask that you take the time to reflect on how being more proactive about consumer and personal information 10 years ago may have lessened the epidemic of identity theft that we're seeing in the nation today. So that having been said, I am more than happy to answer any questions you might have on this technology or this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Fulton. Question about, I guess I need to get my little visual back out. The first part of the bill requires labeling. I'm looking on page one of the bill, and it says a provider. And I take it does a provider is the manufacturer or the person that would, you know, issues this card? Is that who the provider would be? This looks like it's from a HID Corporation. So they'd be the provider?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, the provider would be, and we do have Terry Bannister available who drafted the bill for us, and if I misspeak, I would appreciate it if you corrected me, Terry. But it's my understanding that a provider would be not necessarily the manufacturer, but rather the business that's using it, or it could be a government office. As in this case, it's legislative affairs that has issued you that ID. Well, and I believe they would be considered the provider.
Page 5 of the bill, line 28, provider means a person who sells, offers to sell, or issues an electronic communication device. So I would hope that it would mean HID Corp, because if someone's going to put a stamp on this thing that says, hey, this has got an RFID in it, they seem like the perfect entity to do so. So that I know, you know, every time I go into the building through the back door, which I do every single day of the week, I guess at that point I would know that someone's potentially able to keep track of that. But maybe more to the point, does your bill allow a consumer to know how much of their personal information is stored on the chip that they're carrying around inside their pocket? Because that seems like like the potential for us. I mean, this thing just gets me in the building. I don't even know if anybody knows it's associated with me. I suppose it is through a.
Yes, they do.
Everyone's nodding at it like, yes, they do keep track when I come and go. Well, wait till they see how many hours I put in. They'll be so proud of me.
Yes, they will.
But more to the point, is there something in the bill that allows a consumer to know sort of what, how much of their own personal data is stored on these chips?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you turn to page 3, under the section at the bottom of the page, the section entitled Forms of Consent, if you go to the next page, page 4, it says an electronic or written record, excuse me, this is back on page 3, it continues into page 4, an electronic or written record, the record must, at a minimum, clearly and conspicuously state the provider's privacy policy and the manner in which information relating to the consumer will be collected and disseminated.
And you know, we could add, Senator French, Mr. Chairman, we could add manner and type of information. I think the intent was clearly to do that, and back on page 2, under consent required, the provider shall, before the sale or issuance of an electronic communication device, notify the consumer that the electronic communication device transmits personal information about the consumer. And so I would envision that that would be the type of, but if we need to make it more clear, then let's do so.
Yeah, I mean, it just, it seems to me that, you know, if I know every time I open the back door that someone's keeping track of the fact that Hollis French's car just opened the door and that's it, okay, that's fine. But if I knew that they had my bank account number, my DMV number, my Social Security number every time I walk through that door, I might say, you know what, I'm not using that thing anymore because I don't trust it. I'm going to walk around the front of the building into the front door where no one keeps track of where I come and go. Just as if I had this information on my credit card, I would think twice before I opened it up in cars and swiped it past the car's reader. I might decide to say, you know, I'm just not going to use it in that manner. I'll give you my number, like I might over the internet, and just give you my number, but I'm not going to wave this card around knowing that it's got one of these, you know, you're going to carry this much sort of personal information of mine inside the chip.
And I would agree and think that's a very good point, Mr. Chairman. And if I misspeak here, Senator McGuire, I hope you would correct me, but I think we would be happy to put like more information into the bill that would include that.
And I think section 48.02.0 is very close to having that, and so I'd look for a word or two to go in there to tighten that up. But please proceed if I stopped you. Or Senator Wilikowski, you have a question? Senator Terrio?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think you indicated, well, if you go into the store, you might not use your credit card. You'll swipe it instead or whatever. But I think part of the concern is knowing what all information is being beamed out of your card, so the person standing next to you in the cookie aisle is not getting the information. Right. You maybe have no intent of using that particular credit card, but you have no way of knowing, or you need to know, what information is being sent out by, you know, to devices that collect the information.
Right.
So that needs to be spelled out here, because you might decide to shred the card.
Never accept it, right? Never, never leaving the house. Yeah. Senator McGuire.
And on that point, that's the point of this bill, really, is that, you know, there are some great uses for RFID technology, but there are some uses that, again, if a consumer so chooses, great, but I think a lot of Alaskans are unaware of the kind of information that's being collected about them and being used. And so really it's more about information. And if people so choose, you know, they want that extra $50 rebate or whatever it is, whatever incentive is offered, great. At least you're on notice for what that is.
Right. When you get ready to pay your $50 toll for driving across the new bridge to Point McKinsey, you know, you may decide to go ahead and acquiesce in having, you know, an easy pass on your car that lets you sail through there. And knowing that all it has in there is just enough information for them to deduct some money from your bank account. Or you may decide that's just too risky because someone, you know, could set up a – have there been breaches? Have there been data breaches? The Stanford technology article was quite useful, and I was surprised really at the degree to which folks could crack passports and other items that I took to be highly secure. But have there been financial transactions that were sort of intercepted – through RFID technology capturers.
And in my research, Mr. Chairman, there hasn't been any documented examples of that actually happening, but as Mr. Sniffen pointed out in the last committee hearing, he wouldn't be surprised if it was occurring out there, and that's just because it would be very difficult to prove exactly how identity theft occurs, if it's occurring via RFID or if they dug that information out of somebody's trash or if they got it from a piece of mail. It's hard to determine. But as of yet, there is no demonstrated examples of people. There's only anecdotal evidence of people cracking those RFID devices.
And are they in and to what degree are they RFIDs in use commercially, you know, for the average consumer in the state of Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a difficult thing to quantify. Some data I can throw out there is that it's really growing and expanding at an amazing rate. I believe the statistic I remember reading was that in 2006 there was about a billion point three of these things floating around out there. Of course, this is worldwide. And then in a single year, in 2007 it jumped up to 4 billion and something. So I think it's hard to quantify exactly how many Alaskans are using these RFID devices.
Senator McGuire.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the things that this bill will help us do is figure that out.
Sure. Sure. Any opposition to the bill so far in the previous committee?
There were two people who provided public testimony in opposition to the bill. One was from EPC.
She signed up, I think, to testify here in a little bit. We'll get to her. And
then there was another gentleman who testified from the American Electronics Association.
Okay, interesting. Other questions for the bill's sponsor or for Mr. Fulton? Senator Terrio.
When you talk about the 1 billion or 4 billion of these devices that are out there, they're not all credit cards, though, with personal information. I mean, some of them they're put in the product. So it's just tracking a product, you know, an electronic component or something like that. So there's no danger of any kind of breach of security on that front, is there?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, no, that's a very good point. The scope of this bill is somewhat narrow in that it just addresses RFID devices that transmit personal information. So it wouldn't be aimed at the vast majority of this 4 billion devices, which are probably transmitting just simple serial numbers and are used in supply chain management and things like that never have anything to do with consumers or individuals.
Okay, and then just the technology, our little white car to get in the building, I don't think it's got a battery in it, but it's some kind of signal sent out which activates the device, provides the energy that it needs then to direct a signal back to the receiving?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio. There are two basic types, and there's some other subtypes, but there's two basic types of RFID devices. One is active and one is passive. The active RFID devices are the larger ones, and they do contain their own power source, some sort of a battery or whatnot, and they pretty much transmit that signal all the time, and they transmit over a longer distance. The passive types are the smaller ones, the ones we're starting to see more and more of, particularly in the retail industry. And I'm pretty sure that's also what's in our security cards. But with a passive RFID tag, it picks up the energy being transmitted in electronic radio waves sent from the reader. It picks that up and uses that energy to create a signal and send it back to the reader. So it doesn't have to have its own independent power supply.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So the majority, if not all, sort of consumer RFIDs are likely to be passive.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
But there must be a variety of strengths of detectors, if you will, because while I have to get my card fairly close to the door detector in order for it to register and open the door, automobiles going through toll booth detectors are going at 60 miles an hour, and there's got to be you know, a couple of feet or better separation. So they must be at a different horsepower, so to speak.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's a very good example of the difference between a passive tag and an active tag. The active tag is sending that signal. The toll passes are all active.
Ah, they are. So when a consumer buys one of those, you've got an active, you've got something that's actually emitting a signal itself on your car.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, didn't know that. Further follow-up.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I wanted to do is alert members to the changes that were made. There's a summary of changes there in the Labor and Commerce Committee, and I didn't know if people had questions about that for Trevor on those changes.
I read the memo, but maybe if you just want to walk through them.
I don't think there's a need. I just wanted
to make sure folks are aware of it.
Aware.
Yeah, it's the sectional dated today.
Yeah.
Okay, from Ms. Bannister. Senator Terrio.
And so why do we have the original bill, then we got a blank CS, and then we've got the CS, L, and C?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio. When we put in a request to have this bill heard, we used the blank CS as a placeholder until the CS from Labor and Commerce had come off the presses. Okay. And I believe they both ended up in there. So I apologize for that, but we are working off version echo. Okay. We're not asking for any committee substitute to be adopted in this committee.
And is this based on model legislation or draft legislation from another state? And if so, where?
It was, Mr. Chairman, it was based on a piece of legislation that is in the state of Washington or came out of state of Washington. And there have been over 50 pieces of legislation drawn up in 27 different states over the last several years on RFID legislation.
Seems like people are interested in the topic. Maybe we should turn now to public testimony, unless there's further questions right at the moment. Let's turn to public testimony. We do have one Allison Fleming signed up to testify on this bill. Ms. Fleming, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you go ahead and put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Allison Fleming, and I work for EPC Global. Thank you for allowing me to participate in today's hearing on Senate Bill 293. Just to give you a little bit of background, EPC Global is a not-for-profit organization working on international standards for RFID applications. We are part of GS1, a standards organization that is in over 108 countries. Industries that participate in our standards development process include aerospace, retail, entertainment, defense, healthcare, chemical, pharmaceutical, transportation, and logistics. These industries use the electronic product code, or EPC, which is a type of RFID application. The EPC is a unique number that is used to identify a specific item in the supply chain, similar to a string of numbers on a barcode. This unique number is stored on an RFID tag, which combines a silicon chip and an antenna. Once the EPC is read from the tag, it can be associated with data that's held in a secure database, where you could find information such as where an item originated or the date of its production. EPC data is about products. It's not about people, and the EPC tag does not carry any of an individual's personally identifiable information. It only contains information about the product. It is important to note that as far as we're concerned, the EPC RFID technology is in its infancy. And in the short term, EPC RFID applications will be at the container and the case and pallet level, with item-level tagging applications on a wide-scale basis many years away. As you probably know and was shared with you before before my testimony, RFID is a technology that can be used for many different applications. In the retail supply chain, it's used to mechanically read an EPC in an item. These items can be as diverse as computer printers to a case of diapers, and the EPC gives more information about a product than a typical barcode. In the future, we expect that this extra information could help expedite every step in the supply chain from manufacturing to checkout. The improvements could result in substantial benefits for consumers, such as increased product availability and faster, more efficient product recalls. Improved food safety is another potential benefit because the EPC allows manufacturers and retailers to monitor production, expiration dates, and temperature control to ensure food freshness. EPC can also reduce counterfeiting in a variety of product categories, from toys to electronics to razor blades. And most importantly, the technology has the potential to help save lives. The FDA has encouraged the use of RFID to help prevent counterfeit prescription drugs from reaching consumers by tracking products from their source. In conclusion, in the next couple of years are going to be crucial to the development of the technology. Laws requiring a specific type of notice, written consent, or deactivation at the point of sale could have the effect of stifling the innovation and adoption and delaying potential benefits to consumers and businesses in Alaska and around the globe. Specific legislation regulating the technology is not flexible and could result in negative impact on the advancement of EPC and RFID as new post-purchase benefits and uses are uncovered. And we urge you to be prudent and pragmatic in considering measures to regulate the technology. And I want to thank you for your time again today.
Thank you, Ms. Fleming. I have one question for you. You referred many times to sort of EPC RFID.
Mm-hmm.
And is that like a particular sort of RFID that your organization is working with?
Yes, it is. And it's the specific number that's used for supply chain applications.
Does your company deal with the more consumer sort of end of RFID?
Well, our members are our retailers, folks that are in defense, healthcare, chemicals. So just to give you an idea, the members of our board of directors include companies such as Hewlett-Packard or Kimberly-Clark, Dow Chemical, Lockheed Martin, Novartis, the Sony Corporation, Walmart, Johnson & Johnson, and Procter & Gamble.
Okay, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, are your organizations using this more in sort of supply chain management and warehousing and logistics and so forth, or using it more at point of sale operations where you're interacting with an individual consumer buying certain items?
Right now, the technology is mostly used at the case and pallet level. And we see item-level tagging applications to be many years away. However, there are occasionally pilots where you may see something tagged at the item level that the consumer would come in direct contact with.
Okay, any specific portions of the bill you're concerned about, or is this just sort of a generic, approach?
We are concerned with the notice section, the consent section, and the deactivation at the point of sale sections of the bill.
Any other questions for Ms. Fleming? Mr. Senator Wilikowski.
I'm just trying to understand where your concern lies. I guess from my perspective, what this bill is trying to do is to prevent people from unwittingly having these cards or devices and then, or even having them and then having it used in ways that they don't necessarily agree with. And I guess I just don't understand why the stores would be opposed to this. What am I missing here?
Our stores, we have consumer protection guidelines that our companies agree to, including that include information like such as providing notice and giving the consumer the choice to have something discarded or removed, or in the future maybe disable an RFID tag. As far as notice goes, our issue is that there are very few items tagged at the consumer item level right now, but in the future to have something that's tagged specifically for the state of Alaska would provide problems for our members who have a global supply chain. And at this point, for the deactivation at the point of sale, there's really no effective means for retailers to automatically deactivate EPC tags. Right now, most of the tags that a consumer, or any tag that a consumer would come into contact with, would most likely be on the packaging of an item, and so as they were to open the item packaging, they would be able to throw away the tag with the cellophane or packaging around an item.
Follow-up questions? Ms. Fleming, I don't see any other questions for you. Thanks for appearing in front of the committee this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I add one other thing?
Certainly.
Mr. Fulton was asked about legislation in other states, and he is correct. There has been a lot of RFID information or legislation proposed. However, there has not been any comprehensive bill such as this one in Alaska that's been passed, and the Washington state legislation that originally looked like Senate Bill 293 was changed to ask people to look at the behavior of people using RFID for illegal means and not specifically looking at notice, deactivation, et cetera.
Ms. Fleming, maybe you can tell me this. This seems like a issue that cries out for a federal solution. What, if anything, is happening at the congressional level?
I know there was a hearing about this technology about 3 years ago. Since then, we have not had any bills on the federal level move. There is an RFID Senate caucus. Caucus members meet to discuss the technology and where the technology is going. But aside from that, I have not heard of any other legislation.
Senator McGuire.
And thank you. And on that point, this is an opportunity for Alaska to be a leader in an area that, as the chairman just pointed out, cries out for legislation. And we have done that in the past in different areas. I think there will be federal legislation that comes at some point. Ms. Fleming is right that when these bills are introduced, and I can tell you the sponsor of the bill in Washington State and I have had many conversations, and what ends up happening is that these bills get introduced, and then the lobbyists from the companies start coming in. And so what we try to do is, frankly, do this very quietly, get out ahead of it, and get it as far as we possibly could, because we knew that the pressure would come down from the different companies, and I won't name names of what they are, because it's in their best interest to do what they want in terms of collecting your data and using it how they want. But it's in our best interest as policymakers to look out for our constituents who don't have a voice in this process, who in most cases are completely unaware that their information is being collected and tracked in such a way. And so I would just suggest to Ms. Fleming that if the concern would be about Alaska tagging versus others, why not adopt a policy that would be an international policy applying to all products that go out? That would be one that strikes a balance between the consumer and those wishing to make money off the consumer.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. Next up we have to testify is Melissa Ngo. Ma'am, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And I'm sorry, I probably didn't do justice to your last name, but you can tell us how to pronounce it when you introduce yourself, and I'll be better after that.
Sure. Chairman, Vice Chairman, and members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to appear before you today. My name is Melissa Ngo, and I'm Senior Counsel at the Electronic Privacy Information Center in D.C. EPIC is a nonpartisan public interest research organization established...
Ms. Ngo, you'll have to get a little closer to the microphone. You're a soft-spoken person, and we're having a hard time hearing you.
Sure. EPIC is a nonpartisan public interest research organization established in 1994 to focus public attention on emerging civil liberties issues. I've submitted a longer written statement for the record. EPIC has considerable expertise on technology issues, including those associated with RFID. It's testified about RFID and its security problems before the U.S. Congress and state legislatures and submitted detailed analyses on RFID programs to federal agencies. As has been discussed, RFID technology is rapidly increasing. It's used in EasyPass highway systems, passports, various ID cards such as university ID cards, credit cards and debit cards, as well as supply chain management. And as this technology is increasingly used, we must be aware of the many problems inherent in the use of this technology. In the absence of effective security techniques, RFID tags are remotely and secretly readable. Now, companies often say that wireless technologies such as RFID systems should be used because they are convenient. However, with this convenience comes a significant security cost. One high-profile example demonstrates the security programs associated with the use of RFID technology. Last week, the Dutch government announced that the security of access keys that are based on the widely used MIFARE Classic RFID chip has been compromised because several researchers have been able to hack into the system. 1 billion cards across the world are use these RFID chips. This includes government building access cards and, for example, Boston's Charlie card for its transportation systems. Now, these hacks would allow criminals to clone the cards. That means that criminals would have access to building access keys and fraudulent transportation cards. And there is a difference between products and people. Use of RFID for supply chain management has never really been controversial. However, once it comes into contact with a person, once it can lead to a situation where there's a unique identifier attached to a person and then a profile created about a person, that's when there is a considerable problem. And we believe that though we strongly support SB 293 and many of its provisions, there are several ways in which it can be improved. And the first and most important way is we urge the committee to also address in SB 293 unique identifiers linked to databases containing personally identifiable information. I mean, when people say that it's not connected to personally identifiable information, I ask, if not your credit card, your university ID card, your passport, then what else could be personally identifiable information? Though companies have urged against this regulation, unique identifiers should be covered under SB 293 because the misuse or abuse of such unique identifiers could be as risky as misuse or abuse of Social Security numbers. As I said, EPIC strongly supports SB 293. We support the labeling requirements, the requirement of obtaining consumer consent for continued activation after the article is bought, and obtaining consumer consent for reactivation of the tags. We also support the prohibition against unauthorized scanning and reading of RFID tags. Beyond the request that there be regulations for unique identifiers, we also recommend an enforcement provision with a private right of action. SB 293 previously had an enforcement provision through the Attorneys General. However, we believe that it should be both through the Attorneys General and through a private right of action, because in that way, individuals can protect their rights. Also, we ask for stronger provisions on deactivation of tags, including the possibility of permanent deactivation so that it can't be turned back on, and clear and prominent labeling of RFID readers and transponders as well, so that people can know that these readers are there. And I agree with Senator McGuire, who said that Alaska should be a leader in protecting consumers from misuse of RFID technology. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and I'll be pleased to answer any questions that you have.
Any questions from members of the committee for Ms. No? I don't see any, but thanks so much for taking the time to testify this afternoon.
Thank you.
I think I have a question for Ms. Bannister, and I'm looking at, I'm just trying to figure out whether the concerns I have regarding the consent provisions on page 2, lines 20 through 25, aren't sort of in there by implication. Ms. Bannister, you heard the questions I asked Mr. Fulton, and that was whether the consumer would know what information is being disclosed, and what's your view as to whether or not this is specific enough to capture that idea?
Mr. Chairman.
And you'll have to get a little closer to the microphone. Yep, sorry, just to make a record. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
I would say that this doesn't specify that particular item. It does indicate that it's personal information, and the bill does indicate what personal information is in the definitions, but it does not, I think it does not tell the person
what information is being disclosed. Yeah.
Or what is being transmitted, or what is on the item itself.
If we took a 5-minute at ease, do you think you'd be able to draft a sentence or a phrase that grabbed that so we could insert it as an amendment?
Well, I have something that I was working on while you were talking.
Good.
That we could, a conceptual one, because you never know until I get back to my office and see, it affects this section or
right.
that section.
Right.
But what I had come up with was, in 020 on after line 22, after line on line 23, after transmits personal information about the consumer, put in a comma and then say, identify the type of personal information that is contained on or that may be scanned or read from the electronic communication device, comma, and then go on. Something like that.
Yes, that's exactly what I had in mind. So why don't we propose? Actually, I'm going to propose an amendment to the bill, and it's going to say, and you're about to read the words that it's going to contain. So
okay.
Go ahead. Amendment number one will say, on line. Go ahead.
On line 23, after consumer, insert a comma, and then the words identify the type of personal information that is contained on or that may be scanned or read from the electronic communication device, comma.
That's amendment number one, and I'm moving amendment number one. Is there objection to amendment number one? Senator Terrio.
Was that on page two?
Yes. Page two, yes, okay. Thank you. Page two, line 23.
Page two.
And we will call that a conceptual amendment since it may have to be...
Slightly adjusted
to conform to other portions of the bill. But that is a conceptual amendment number one. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, amendment number one is adopted. Thank you, Ms. Bannister. Any other comments from you or general comments on the bill?
The only other comment is a question whether or not on page four at the top under the consent, if I don't know if you feel it's needed there to identify that use the same language again there, or if we have it sufficiently. We've already said it in the 020 consent, so I guess forget that okay. comment. I think it's already taken care of.
You're satisfied with the bill otherwise. Mr. Yes. Fulton, are you satisfied with the bill otherwise?
I'm satisfied, Mr. Chairman, but more importantly, is Senator McGuire satisfied?
I am satisfied. That's a great amendment because you could see people getting around and saying, well, we've said there is personal information generally, but not what type.
Is there anybody else here in the room or online who'd like to testify about SB 230? I'm sorry, 293. Hearing and seeing none, public testimony is closed. That brings the bill up before the full committee. I think it's a good bill. I think it's... something we should get in front of rather than behind. And so I'm interested in the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill number 293, version E, out of this committee as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the bill moves out of committee.
Thank you.
Next up is CS for Senate Bill number 234, Judiciary. That's the governor's crime bill that is coming to you today in the form of a CS that is /C. If we could get a motion to adopt that.
I'd make that motion, Mr. Chair.
And I'll object for the purposes of discussion. And we are working off /Charlie. We've got a couple new provisions. And probably the ones we ought to start with are number one and number two. And just so the committee members know, my intention is to work on the bill today, work on the bill Wednesday, and I hope we've got something to move out of committee on Wednesday.
Okay.
Because this crime bill needs to get going.
That version is now available.
And so let's go to sections 1 and 2. Sections 1 and 2 are basically ideas that were brought to us at a crime summit. They are about getting electronic reporting of pawn shop transactions into a format that the police department can make use of. I'm trying to remember, who do we have to describe this section? Sergeant Pickrell.
She's going to be able to talk about e-reporting, not about the specific language.
Right. Let's take a short at ease. Go back on the record. We are on SB 234, and sections 1 and 2 are going to need a little more tweaking, but the idea is to have, as was discussed in the Crime Summit, electronic reporting of pawn shop transactions mm-hmm. in cities that have more than 5,000 people in them. The idea is to not make garage sales reportable or used bookstore transactions, Salvation Army transactions reportable, but for items, for places that actually loan money on secondhand articles, which really is about as close to a pawn shop as you can get under state law, have those be reported in an electronic format to law enforcement to make those transactions more easily searchable and therefore make items that frequently turn up in pawn shops as a result of burglaries and robberies more easily locatable. I understand that most pawn shops in Anchorage are doing this now. This would be an extension of the idea out to Fairbanks, to Juneau, to Kenai, and a few other towns. And to explain how it works now in Anchorage, we have Sergeant Pickrell on the line from the Anchorage Police Department. Sergeant Pickrell, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Maybe you could give us a little background about how this works now in Anchorage and what benefit it provides you and the rest of the public.
Here in Anchorage, we've got something around 3,500 pawn transactions a week. A number of those transactions are items that have been reported to us as stolen either in a burglary or theft or other means. And because of the reporting requirement that's put on the pawn shop, we're able to recover a large number of those items. Prior to electronic reporting, it was required that someone from the police department travel to each pawn shop to pick up the lists. But now, with their electronic reporting, the email, it's much easier for both parties concerned.
And what sort of pushback do you get from the pawn shops on this? Is this onerous? Is this difficult? Does this consume a bunch of their time? Do you know?
No, I think when we first started the email procedure, most of them were very open to it. I think it made it easier for them as well. We've only got one pawn shop in town that does not do it. He sends his information via the mail, regular U.S. Postal Service. But all the other pawn shops, I think, enjoy it.
And how many, out of those 3,500 pawn transactions a week, how many of those items turned out to have been stolen?
This is a real rough guess. Maybe 5%, maybe 10%. I really don't know a number on that.
But even assuming it's 5%, that's 175 items per week that pop up in Anchorage pawn shops that can be returned to their owners through the application of this fairly straightforward record-keeping device. Is that right?
Right. The number is not going to be that big, but it's still a good number of items that we recover from pawn shops. And with that, of course, it creates leads in the investigation, and a lot of those cases we're able to bring them to prosecutions.
Anything else you want to say about this provision?
No, other than it's a big help to us, and I'm sure the other jurisdictions will find it to be a big help to them as well.
Okay, thank you, Sergeant. Any questions for the sergeant while he's on the line? Senator Wilikowski.
I don't know if it's for the sergeant or for someone else, but I'm just curious how on page one you define a person who lends money on secondhand articles. Is there someone that can give us that definition?
That's why we had asked for a drafter to be here, and they're like everybody else. They're getting busy this time of year, so we're having trouble. This provision is going to need a little more massage. Oh, there, Mr. Luckup walks in as if on cue. Mr. Luckup, we've got a warm seat for you right there. Don't go to the back of the room. Come to the front. Because you were, Mr. Luckup, nice to see you this afternoon. Put yourself on the record, and Senator Wilikowski, I'm not going to make you guess the question that Senator Wilikowski just asked. He's going to state it again.
All right. For the record, my name's Jerry Luckup, Legislative Counsel for the Division of Legal Services.
Jerry, I had a question on Section 1. How you define, quote, a person who lends money or on secondhand articles under A?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it's not really defined. We have provisions in Title 8 that don't per se regulate pawn shops, but we talk about loaning money on items and different record keeping that has to occur. The state has not, has never gone through actually doing much regulation to the extent of pawn shops. It's fairly open as to how that will apply. If you loan money on articles, it will apply. It's not an area I usually draft in, but this got rolled in here. So we refer to pawn shops, but we always talk about whether or not it's a person that engages in the business of buying and selling secondhand articles or lending money on secondhand articles. We never actually use the term as a legislature, pawn shops. We use this phrase to refer to people who engage in those activities that we would normally think are pawn shops.
And just for the record, I'm looking at the section that it's referring to, which is not in this CS, and it does talk about a person engaged in the business of buying and selling. What I was worried about was inadvertently requiring, if I go someplace and I want to just lend someone $10 to buy something, let's say, I wouldn't be caught in that, and you're telling me that I'm correct, right?
I wouldn't see that as the intent of this section, that it would apply to persons who just loan money to friends or something like that. And you're receiving, I think you would have to be receiving the item in exchange and holding that item until the person repays you, I think is what the section is basically referring to there.
Similarly, there are places in town where you can sell your used clothing, used books, things of that nature. Would those transactions fall under this section or not?
To me, they wouldn't. Again, we aren't loaning money on those items. And even a shop that takes in consignment items like used clothing or bookstores, they aren't giving you money as a loan in exchange for holding that item for you to redeem it or anything like that.
They're buying them outright.
Well, they're either buying them outright or you are giving it to them, like the Salvation Army, you're giving them the item for them to sell and they would receive all the profit from that. Or they are engaging in selling the item on your behalf, but they aren't loaning you any money in that. They're going to give you a percentage of the return when the item sells, and that's your typical consignment shop sort of procedure. And as the way I read this language, it would not apply to those items, and I don't know that our current statute has ever been applied to those items. So, I didn't misspeak. At one point, we do talk about our pawn shop items do relate all the way back to, in some cases, until 1949, but we talk about this business of loaning, lending money on secondhand articles. We do have a statute that was added, 0876040, that was added in 1981 that does use the term pawnbroker in that statute, but again, it does not define it, and it's only in relation to what happens when someone does not come to redeem their item. And that statute, I think, was put in there so the pawnbroker had some authority for engaging then in a sale of an item pursuant to the contract.
Further questions from Mr. Luckupt? One of the things that's going to change, we're going to clean this language up between now and Wednesday, is the bill right now on page 2, line 3, says data accessible on the internet by law enforcement, and I think that is something we're going to change just to make electronically available. I think an emailed list to the police department is really the idea, not to have a database that the public mm-hmm. can search of all pawned articles in the state. And so I think that's something we'll continue to sort of craft between now and Wednesday. But the idea is to comport with the suggestion made, I think it was the chief of police from Wasilla that was crying out for an electronic list of the things getting pawned in Wasilla because of the large number of house burglaries out there. And they're just in the dark as to what's showing up in the pawn shops. Mm-hmm. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and this idea has been around for years, and it has been brought to me by people in our community in Anchorage as well. And the issue is that you have a burglary, you then want to go out and try to find your items, and you're literally forced to go to every single pawn shop in the community, and you're on a time clock there. And so I think it'll benefit a lot of people, and it's an idea that whose time is well past. It should have been in it a long time ago. So commend you for putting it in.
Further questions from Mr. Luckup? Seeing none, I know we've got some folks on the line, and we're going to kind of hopscotch around here, but I've got folks on the line who want to testify, I think, about the bill in general. We'll have some specific questions for the Department of Law as we get to them. But let's turn to public testimony. We have Quinlan Steiner, I know, on the line. Mr. Steiner, are you there?
Hello, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Steiner, welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record and your affiliation, and we'd be happy to hear your thoughts on this crime bill.
Thank you. This is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I have reviewed this bill, and I think some of the concerns that I had were raised with the Department of Law previously, and we discussed some language that might clean up some of the problems that we both saw, in particular with regard to the involuntary commitment proceedings. And that was one of my biggest concerns. And that language isn't reflected here, but we discussed with Annie Carpany at the Department of Law some language that would work.
Mr. Steiner, you're kind of cutting out from the mic, but I thought I heard you say that your issues have been resolved.
We discussed language with the Department of Law. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's a little better.
Yeah, we discussed language with the Department of Law, and I think we pretty much agreed to language that would cure up our concerns and I think satisfy law's concerns. They're not reflected in this version of the bill. I believe we discussed it over on the House side. And I'm sure I can get you that language. I have a copy of it.
Yeah, Mr. Steiner, it's imperative that you do so. The bill, as I say, is needs to move from one body to the other before long in order for it to become law. My understanding is that it hasn't been moving on the House side. This bill, I'd like to leave this committee by Wednesday. So if you have suggestions, we need to see them.
Sure, I can get those to you today.
That'd be excellent, and I hope you're working with Ms. Carpinetti's here in the room today. I don't know if you've been working with her or not.
Yeah, we discussed the commitment proceedings at length, and I think we pretty much had it hammered out to what would satisfy us and law.
And maybe you can just kind of raise the issues for us today so we just know what parts you're talking about and the language you're thinking of so we can have it in mind for Wednesday's hearing.
Sure. The sections regarding involuntary commitment when a criminal defendant is found incompetent are sections 9, 10, and 11. And our concern was that there was no outlet for certain cases that didn't really require a commitment for evaluation. A perfect example would be criminal trespass cases that are relatively minor and the client may have been found incompetent on numerous occasions. This could lead to almost a year commitment on something that you would normally receive only 10 days and not involve threatening or otherwise dangerous conduct. So we drafted some language to require a finding of dangerousness to coincide with this, and I think it would take care of the concerns of the state, which were more dramatic cases, for instance, arson, and that those types of cases were dangerous high. And that was the primary concern. We'd also had some debate about Section 11, which is a rebuttable presumption regarding the mental illness of somebody who's found incompetent. That being somewhat inconsistent with a possible basis for incompetency, which could be not a mental illness, but a disability. But we never reached an agreement on that issue. But it's worth, I think, looking at. Because somebody could be found incompetent without actually being mentally ill.
Can you give me a more concrete example of who that would be? Is it someone who's had brain damage or some kind of physical issue that doesn't really qualify as a mental illness, but still, for whatever reason, just can't function?
It could be mental retardation. It could be developmentally disabled, autistic, those types of things.
Thank you. Those are good examples. Let me ask you, any other comments on the incompetency sections?
No, I think the language, it's kind of a complicated section, and it took us a while to hammer out the language, but I think the language we did hammer out should cover all the concerns, allowing the state to get an opportunity to review somebody who's charged with a serious crime and may potentially be, permanently or otherwise incompetent.
Thank you. I do have what Section 8, did you take a look at Section 8 regarding the search warrants?
Yes.
And did you have any, and what's the view of the Public Defender's Office on that section?
I think legally there's no bar to it. I think the policy concerns that were in place, at the time that was written, was to ensure that people weren't calling everything in. And I realize there was a case in the rural community where some officers were required to travel 8 hours downriver to get a warrant. Those seem to be a valid concern. I would just ask the committee to, consider whether or not this would be used just to call in all warrants where, you may present a witness who is from a criminal environment. And I think in those situations it would be important for a judge to actually get a look at it. But there are vast concerns about traveling in a state such as Alaska. But I would just point that out.
Thank you. Any other comments on any other portions of the bill while I've got you on the line?
One comment I had was with Section 3 with regard to making the third domestic violence assault a felony. This particular section was similar to a draft that went through on the House side, and there were substantial changes made to it on the House side based upon some concerns. In particular, the concerns were that the predicate crimes, the two misdemeanor predicate crimes, could be non-assaultive conduct.
Fear assaults?
Fear assaults, reckless endangerment, custodial interference were serving as predicates, and that the actual C felony offense could also have been non-assaultive. And those were taken out, and it changed so that it required assaultive conduct. And it also put a time limit on it that the other bill didn't have a look-back period. It was open-ended. and I believe they put a 10-year look back on it. I'm not totally sure about that, but I believe they did, which took care of some other concerns with respect to domestic violence. I think what the committee should consider is the broad definition of household member, which is how you define domestic violence. In the statutes, when you're getting a restraining order, there's a very broad definition, and that can include people who've ever lived together, even roommates, if they'd have been college roommates or living on a fishing boat or in a cannery together, they would constitute domestic violence, domestic partners for a later criminal offense.
Mr. Steiner?
Yes.
How broad do you really think that is? I mean, there are crab boats that are big, there are canneries that are big. If I'm in one tiny little room in a cannery and down the hall 10 doors is another person, that wouldn't be a domestic partner of mine, would it?
Well, certainly with regard to sort of the common understanding of domestic partner, it would not be, but I do think it would be encompassed by the definition. If you were living in a house or, you know, sharing rooms in a house, even a boarding house, you really would be in the same sort of residence, and you could make a solid argument, and I think it would be a legitimate one. But I don't think that's the intent of the acts regarding domestic violence, although I do think it makes more sense in a protective order situation where you're looking for something as broad as possible because you're operating under a very short time frame and trying to maximize protection. But when you transfer that into the criminal environment where there's more time to examine culpability, the broad definition tends to make less sense. And an interesting part of that definition of household member is also dating. I've yet to find somebody who can really give me a good definition of what that is, and that may mean very different things in different parts of the state and in different perceptions among the people who may be dating. Someone may see something as a date while somebody else may not. It's totally undefined, and I think that's worth considering when deciding to use that for criminal culpability purposes.
All good comments. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Anything else?
I don't think I have any other comments really at this time, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I don't see any right at the moment, but thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have Mr. Adler from API and Mr. Fink from OPA on to answer questions, just so other members of the committee are aware that these gentlemen are available. Do either one of you men, gentlemen want to testify, or are you strictly here to answer questions?
This is Ron Adler, and yes, I would just like to make a Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a brief comment that I, too, am very concerned about all the references to incompetency due to a mental illness in Sections 8 and 9 and 10. I share the same concerns as the previous gentleman who testified, and let me just give you another clear example to help committee members with this. Somebody could be incompetent to stand trial because they continue to do severe maladaptive behaviors in the community as a result of a developmental disability. However, somebody who is mentally ill might conduct a crime and not be able to understand the charges because they're responding to internal stimuli and they're hearing voices. And that might be a very easy way to distinguish between the two groups of people.
Mr. Adler, just so you know, sections that you're calling 8, 9, and 10 in this CS, I think, are 9, 10, and 11. But the only new section is Section 11. The other two sections are existing law, and I don't see any reference to mental illness there. So I think the only section that you're concerned about is Section 11. that says that a defendant charged with a felony found to be incompetent to proceed under this section is rebuttably presumed to be mentally ill. That's the rubbing point for Mr. Steiner and for you.
That's correct.
And why isn't a rebuttable presumption the way to go? Why shouldn't the DA be able to walk in and say, look, we're saying this guy's mentally ill, he's been found incompetent, and why couldn't someone like yourself or some of their doctors jump up and say, I just need a 2-second rebuttal. This person's been autistic and proven to be autistic since the age of 2 years old. Why wouldn't that sort of end the dispute right there?
Well, where will the defendant be during that rebuttal? Will the defendant have already been placed into the custody of the Department of Health and Social Services and the commissioner? Because if the defendant is already at API, one of the unintended consequences of this legislation is a capacity issue at the hospital.
When you say capacity at the hospital, you mean the number of beds available at API?
Absolutely. We only have a 10-bed medium security forensic unit.
And how many of them are occupied right now?
All 10.
And what would happen if this afternoon in Anchorage District Court, a judge were to find a young or old or middle-aged person to be incompetent to proceed and thus rebuttably presumed to be mentally ill? What would happen?
Well, that it would present a problem. we would have to notify licensing and certification, let them know we're going to go one over. What we would do is probably take away the seclusion and restraint room that we use and that is used every once in a while, and do the best we can. It would create serious problems if we go over 11. We would then not only have to notify licensing and certification, but also notify the fire marshal. So the hospital just wasn't built to accommodate more than 10 forensic patients at a time.
On the other hand, how many times have you been overcount in the last, say, 2 years?
I would say 3 times.
And what...
My concern is that this just could open up a number of other referrals into our medium security forensic unit that capacity may not be an issue, but it may be an issue. It's very hard to gauge.
And can you tell me how many do you keep track of the number of defendants in the criminal system found to be incompetent to proceed in the last couple of years?
You know, I would have to go in and get that data and have it available for you on Wednesday.
Do you keep track of that?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that'd be useful information for us to consider as this topic is being mulled over by the committee.
I'll be glad to have that available.
Thank you. Any other concerns from you, Mr. Adler, on the crime bill?
That's it for now.
Thank you. If you'd get that, and if you could convey that information to my office before the hearing, that'd be helpful as well.
I'd be glad to.
How about you, Mr. Fink? You're on the line. Josh Fink.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Let's get your thoughts on the record while we're hearing from folks who work in this area.
Well, I would associate myself with Mr. Quinlan or Mr. Steiner and Mr. Adler's comments. To recap, I do think that it would be worthwhile looking at that broad definition of household, and I do in fact think it is broad and applied in a very broad way. There was a recent incident in the Mat-Su Valley where two cellmates got into a scuffle, and initially it looked like they were going to be charged with domestic violence. It ended up they weren't, but the court was concerned whether the court could ignore the fact that they were cellmates under the law, or whether it was a discretionary call by the DA, and it caused somewhat of a situation. And when one of the definitions of household being live with or ever lived with, that includes cellmates. That's going to include people in assisted living homes. College roommates getting a scuffle 20 years later at a reunion, given that there's no look back and they live together, that would be considered domestic violence. So I mean, I don't want to overemphasize it, but I think there's a real issue there, and I think Mr. Steiner was correct. When the household definition was written in Title 18, it was for the purposes of giving the court broad discretion in fashioning a restraining order. It was not intended to define a domestic relationship for purposes of criminal liability. And the House version actually sets up a new section that defines the domestic violence relationships. And for instance, they limited the living together or have lived together. They made it present tense. So you have to either be living together or have or been in a sexual relationship, have a child, and a couple of other things, but really trying to get to the familial and romantic relationships versus the very broad definitions contained in Title 18.
And Mr. Fink, are you comfortable with the three strikes language that's been adopted by the House? And I think that's not in a crime bill, but in a separate bill by Representative Holmes.
Mr. Chairman, I am. A lot of work went into that, and I commend Representative Holmes for all the work she did. She went in and, I think, took a hard look at the predicate crimes and made sure they were assaultive in nature so as not to be too broad. She then did incorporate a 10-year look back, so the three crimes would have to occur within 10 years. And then she did narrow the definition of household, and I think it's a tight bill, and it gets at the public policy she wants implemented. And yes, I think that's she's got good language in that bill.
It's just so the committee members know, it's been my intention that this Section 3 be more or less a placeholder for that language. I know it has been extensively worked on over on the House side. I've had several conversations with Representative Holmes about that, and I know she's come a long way towards getting language that sort of everybody's happy with, to the extent they can be happy with, can be happy with it. And so I expect on Wednesday we'll have that language here in this bill. Other questions or comments from the stakeholders and members of the criminal justice community? There's one other section I should just bring your all's attention to, and that's Section 4. Section 4 of the bill addresses an issue that I know Safeway and other merchants have had over the years, and that's with detaining individuals that are leaving their establishment with large amounts of material in plain view. They have not had the authority to detain those individuals. It used to be that you had to conceal merchandise in order for a store security guard to be able to sort of grab you and hold you until the police arrive. And this broadens that definition to also allow theft to serve as a predicate. Questions, other questions, comments, concerns, members of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
I'm just looking back at my notes from the last meeting, and I think the department had suggested that they would add Lunestra to Section 6. And I don't know if they've changed their opinion on that.
Lunestra, my name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the criminal division. Lunestra is on the federal schedules, and we had suggested it, but I had been informed that it was a decision not to go ahead. But we don't have any problem with adding Lunestra. It's on the federal schedules.
I was just curious if I had a note that it was in
I had talked to the people, the police in the Valley area, and they said they had seen it, people driving with it, so it was certainly something that we would support adding to federal schedules.
We'll try to get it added. I think it's a good idea.
Okay. Through the chair, may I have a chance to respond to?
Yep, there's been several topics, so you can take them in any order.
I'm just going to choose the probably the most important to the Department of Law, and that's Section 3. In the governor's bill that we're working from, we never had a provision that it be a domestic violence crime for a third strike, a third conviction, a fourth degree assault to become a Class C felony. And I would urge you to consider that now. I know it's not necessarily the most popular approach to it, but it is so much more practical, and it makes so much more sense for our prosecutors to just provide that the third conviction of assault in the fourth degree, A and B, not a fair assault, but the A and B, which in both require physical harm to the individual, that the third conviction of those offenses be a Class C felony if a person has been convicted within the last 10 years of assaultive behavior. And there are different ways that you can consider what the predicate offenses are, but in our law, we don't have a crime involving domestic violence. We don't have, that's not an element of any of our offenses. So in all of these cases, we are going to be having to add that as an element, all of our assaults when they come up. And they're not in the statute right now, so that we're going to have to be going to the jury and having to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime is a crime involving domestic violence. Whereas the governor's approach, and I think Mr. Steiner and Mr. Fink will tell you, is a much cleaner and more preferable approach to it. And I have worked with, on the House side, with Representative Holmes on her version of the bill, helping to get that in as good a position as possible. But from the prosecutor's point of view, leaving that element out is much preferable. You capture everybody that bill captures, and you capture other people too who have been committed, who have been convicted of assaultive behavior, and this is their third in 10 years. And there's a good reason to apply this enhanced penalty to big bullies on the street who beat up other people who aren't in their families. So I would urge you to consider that, because it will make our job a whole lot easier, and it fits into our laws a whole lot better to just have. And Mr. Luckup drafted a really good version of it. He changed assault in the third degree to make another way to commit it by having committed assault in the first and second degrees, excluding fear assaults with various predicates, and I would really urge you to consider that. And there are other things. I have a feeling that Mr. Steiner has...
Actually, I think on this point, Senator Wilkowski and then Senator McGuire have questions.
Sure. I was just going to say, it doesn't make sense, particularly when we're potentially in this realm of fighting over, did the person live with the other person? Did they live in the next room? Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that the cleaner and more practical way to do this is to do it exactly the way Ms. Carpinetti says. If someone's assaulting people three times, that's we need to do something about that person. We need to mm-hmm. get them off the streets and teach them a lesson.
Well, we have some people in Anchorage who have, you know, 12. Remember at the crime summit earlier this year? Ms. Bachman testified, we have people who have convictions for 10 and 12 assault in the fourth degrees. And they're not all domestic violence.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, I was just going to echo same remark. I think we're splitting hairs when we start getting into domestic and not, and you could clearly see a situation that we would say falls into that category but doesn't. And I think at the end of the day, if you're exhibiting fourth degree assaultive behavior on a consistent basis, you know, you're ratcheting up, and I think it's time to say it's a felony. And if that will get your attention, hopefully, I'm not sure what else would. So I'm supportive of keeping it just general.
Mm-hmm. Good comments. Good to know about. Thank you. Other responses you wanted to make to the how about the mentally ill sections and the incompetency?
Mr. Chairman,
sections?
I don't think Mr. Steiner has the recent version, because the provisions in this CS are the ones that we worked on with Mr. Steiner and Mr. Fink. So I don't think he's looking at the same version that we
Yeah, I don't know what happened. The pained look on my staffer's face is because I know we communicated early in today, and we sent him that version. And uh-huh. So I'm not sure if he just had the wrong one in front of him when he testified, but we went out of our way to make certain that before the hearing he had the language. We'll just try it again for Wednesday. Because my sense was that you guys had talked.
We have spent hours together working out this language. And so I'm going to call him right after this hearing, too, and make sure that...
Another drawback to the 90-day session is that you got to, you just can't... These little glitches all of a sudden get take on a greater import.
It would be interesting for you to get their Mr. Fink's and Mr. Steiner's testimony, because they both have represented to me that they liked.
They were happy with.
They liked the governor's version. It's a whole lot cleaner without having.
Back to assault, not often comsy.
Yeah.
Okay, you're hopping around too.
Yeah.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, and I guess I'll even take it one step further. I mean, I'm looking at the title of this, and in the title, it says it's an act relating to penalizing certain recidivist offenders as felons.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly we can do that within the title. But I'm just wondering, have you thought about expanding it even further? And what I'm concerned with, and we saw this in the crime summit, I've seen this in comments from constituents, people who commit various offenses over and over and over again. I'm talking about, and we've heard people who 30, 40, 50 offenses, clearly menaces to society. They're clearly not learning. They're not correcting their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we want to try to rehabilitate the ones that we can, but at some point, you just have to say, you know what, you need to go and sit in a cell and think about your actions for a period of time. And so I'm wondering if you've given any thought to maybe extending this to other types of recidivist offenders. And it's really aimed at getting at those people who commit just dozens of offenses. Mm-hmm. Have you given any thought to that? Would you be supportive of an amendment to that effect?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bilikowski, we have, and there are provisions in our law now, our sentencing law. There are three strikes and you're out. That's very limited.
Three felonies
and you're out, yeah. I guess I would be willing to consider it. The problem is always, you know, there's a big price tag on all of these that we have to try and make it as limited as possible under the considerations that we have. So I guess I would be always willing to consider it, but I think this is a really good start in terms of people who beat up on other people, whether they be a domestic partner or a total stranger.
Just for the record, as you mentioned, the fiscal note that you all should have received for this bill, I'm sorry? It's out on the tables, and on page 2 it shows the cost in 2012 of these provisions to be $9 million a year, and in 2014 to be nearly $17 million. So as we've always said, it's not cheap to prosecute crime.
We have to take it. I would really prefer to take it one step at a time, especially given these figures that we have.
Ms. Carpinetti, I do have a question for you, and that's on page 6 of the bill, section 17. Last hearing we discussed the change from a sort of a tough rule that says you've got to return a search warrant within 10 days mm-hmm. to a more relaxed standard. And Mr. Zabodny made a fairly good case that it needs to be relaxed from time to time. But I have concern about a sort of an open-ended framework there, and I'd like to see an upper limit, like a reasonable time or X days, and, mm-hmm. and to put some number on that so that we're not just sort of waiting in vain or waiting forever for a search warrant return to take place. And I was going to suggest an upper limit of somewhere around 30 days, and I wonder whether that would take care of, you know, 99% of your problems if we extended it to 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that would be fine as long as there were some – we would like to, if you put 30 days, and that's I think, a reasonable time, too, to put some statement in here that you envision – a possibility of going to the court and asking for an extension, because
what happens now if
we go to the court and ask for an extension, and frankly judges are good about cooperating with us, but it just with the 10 days and the extra 10 days not to exceed 10 days, we thought it made sense to provide a longer period of time, and if you were willing to have some sort of reference to a provision for coming back for reexamination by the court.
So could we sort of undo the whole problem if we just said 30 days? That way you'd have to return it within 30 days, or if you go to the court, you can get an extension?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I'll be happy to
check with Mr. Zabodny and see if
talked to him before that, because somebody had told me that I should look at this, and we talked before this hearing, and he said that would be certainly acceptable of 30 days with some sort of provision.
So just leave the rule the way it is and just up the number of days.
And maybe add a little provision for going back for a reasonable extension.
But you've got that now, right? It's the law right now says, however, upon sworn application made before the expiration of the initial, and then it would say 30-day period, the court may for good cause extend the execution period for a reasonable time. And then it says not to exceed
10 days. That's the problem. So it sort of reads like you can only get
ten plus ten, right? Yeah. That's the
so
max.
That's the problem.
Okay, we'll see. I think I just don't want to have an open ended. I want something that gives the court some guidance as to days, and so we'll work on keeping some reasonable lid on that, mm-hmm. and we'll also give the public defender a chance to respond. Other questions or comments from the panel to Ms. Carpinetti or other members? We have other folks here in the room. Anybody else want to testify about the bill or the changes? Some of the things we've talked about today, hearing and seeing none. Anything else to come before the committee? Hearing and seeing none, we'll stand in recess until Wednesday.